In this course, I would like to approach Sri Aurobindo's poetry from the point of view of mantra, metrics, and music. Each of which I believe to be unique to Sri Aurobindo. And Vladimir and I will carry on a kind of subtextual debate about this. But the last hour of Upanishads convinced me even more that Sri Aurobindo's interpretation and application of the principle of mantra is unique. What poetry is or should be for Sri Aurobindo is a special, peculiar intensity of speech. He identifies it as mantra, which indicates both a form and a content. But it is inspirational and transformational in a way that is not even generally understood by the term mantra. The term mantra applies to a superhuman inspiration and speech. Sri Aurobindo applies the term to a kind of poetic creativity that conveys the truth of things, normal human things, in a different way. He says, mantra is a direct and most heightened and intensest and most divinely burdened rhythmic word, which embodies an intuitive and revelatory inspiration, and ensouls the mind with the sight and presence of the very self, the inmost reality of things, not gods, not divine planes of consciousness, things. This is a theory of poetry, he says, which is very different from any that we now hold. And in fact, he says, perhaps no thinking age has been so far removed from such a view. And in the future poetry, when he's exploring different periods and styles, he points out that since the 18th century or so, we have actually lost the ability to read poetry. We have learned to read poetry, but not to read poetry. We look at the words and the images on the page, and we think about what they mean. And by doing that, by generally accepting through the last couple of hundred years that that's what we're supposed to do, that that's what poetry is, we lose touch with the essence of poetry. And the kind of poetry that Sri Aurobindo bases his theory upon is mostly classical mythical poetry. The poetry of Homer and Vyasa and Valmiki, the poetry of Virgil, and the subject matter of those poets was heroic, the heroic time, when the gods and men conversed, when the gods were visible, when the poet mediated. And so he says to read Homer in the original Greek is literally to bring down the gods from Mount Olympus. The poetry of the Veda is meant to bring down the gods, to reveal them, to allow that word to express itself, which reveals that of which it speaks to the hearer. It's speech, divine speech. Savitri is, he says, the goddess of illumined speech. And he refers to her continually in Savitri as the word, the rhythm, the sound, and the silence. She is the word and the silence. And so that word comes from somewhere else, and it comes on a kind of rhythm. It is carried by a kind of rhythm which you hear and through which you see. And so Sri Aurobindo speaks at length about this in the Future Poetry. And he says that this age is farther perhaps than any other from such a view. And then he says, but a greater era of man's living seems to be in promise. But first there must intervene a poetry which will lead him towards it. This is a theory of poetry as revelatory power and guide, a kind of intercessor whose purpose is to cleave the darkness, raise the earth soul to light, and bring down God into the lives of men. Quote. The importance that Sri Aurobindo gives to this theory of poetry can be noted in the archival discovery that Sri Aurobindo revised 20 chapters of the future poetry in 1950. And he spent the years of the 30s and the 40s writing poetry. The master of the supramental knowledge spent those years writing poetry. He worked on Ilian, and in 1942 he published a book on quantitative meter about the theory of poetry that he was applying at that time in Ilian and Savitri and Ahana, the major works that he was writing. His theory of poetry is written about that writing that he was doing. He didn't write the theory of quantitative meter in 1893 when he wrote his early poems, and he didn't write his book on quantitative meter in 1931 when he was writing about the inspiration of poetry from the Overmind. He wrote his about it at length in 1942. And so he was undoubtedly at the very height of his poetic power and artistry. This was when he finished Savitri. This was the big push when many, many chapters of Savitri were added. All of the rest were completed, and both the purpose of it and the style of creating it could not have been more present to his consciousness. So the mere fact of the importance that Sri Aurobindo gave to this work, considering who he was, his mission, is extraordinary. It's unbelievable, in a way. And so, for us to come to understand a bit in depth, a bit fully, if we can understand a bit fully what it is that Sri Aurobindo thought to be so important, to burn the midnight oil for the last 20 years of his life, to say in 1944, I'm very sorry that I don't have more time for Ilian. It's very disturbing that I don't have more time for Ilian. And he didn't finish it. But there's 100 pages of it there, and it's magnificent. And it illustrates very well the theory. So the best way to learn the theory is to read the poetry. There's absolutely no point in talking much about or studying very much the theory, but to know generally something about it helps. It helped me to come to terms with this question. Sri Aurobindo examines the principles of poetic structure that make mantric poetry possible. He writes about metrics, known in English as prosody. How you scan a line of poetry. What are the principles in the construction of a line of poetry? besides inspiration and the descent of force, there is technique also. And Sri Aurobindo mastered this technique of English poetry. But about mantra, about that aspect of the technique, he mentions the powerful sweep, the divine rush, or the assured truth of tread of that greater word music. And he's speaking about something that he calls the principle of quantity, quantitative meter, which he said at that time was not a principle that was applied very consciously in English poetry, although it's always there to some extent. It's present. But in the classical languages, it's very prevalent. And so he endeavored, for very good reason, to bring out in English this principle. The principle of quantity that he insists upon is based upon the same principle found in the classical poetry of Greek and Sanskrit. True quantity, he said, must be something inherent in the tongue, recognizable everywhere in its rhythm, not an artifice or convention governing its verse form, but a technique of nature flowing spontaneously through the very texture of the language as a whole. It is this principle of rhythm and measure which is somehow synonymous with a free outflow of significant sound and harmonious word from the depths of the spirit. Sri Aurobindo defines three fundamental determinants of poetic meter or rhythm: accent, stress, and quantity. And he points out that English poetry is usually constructed on the principles of accent and stress. So, I will demonstrate. And we will hear again and again and again examples of these principles. So don't worry about trying to understand them. They are incomprehensible through analytic description. They can only be heard. But after you hear them, you can also distinguish and define how they work. He points out that the lack of a certain subtlety and power has been responsible for the deficit in English poetry of this principle of quantity. A certain lack of subtlety and power. What could that possibly be? That degree of subtlety and that degree of power which would enable the English poet to bring forth this principle of quantity, which is the outflow of the spirit. I would suggest that it is especially because of a certain extraordinary subtlety and power of poetic consciousness that Sri Aurobindo was able to discover this secret. His consciousness, the yogic consciousness, combined with his poetic genius, enabled him to see this, to do this. He said, "It requires a great poetic force which adds the atmosphere of the unexpressed reality of the thing in itself. A great poetic force which adds the atmosphere of the unexpressed reality of the thing in itself." Even the thing itself doesn't express this degree of its reality, its truth. Even the person, even the flower, even the sunrise, even the vast movement of human civilization doesn't express outwardly the innermost truth of itself. It labors, it lives, it exists for that purpose. But temporal reality is limited. The thing itself, the being of the thing, is unlimited, it's infinite. And so Whitehead says, in philosophy, we always move from the finite to the infinite, and from the infinite to the finite in our attempt to allow the truth of things to become self-evident and then to express that truth. We go from the most incremental here and now specificity to the most general ideal truth, and we constantly try to relate them to each other in order to understand what things really are and not just what they appear to be, because their appearance is not even the full expression of what they are. Sri Aurobindo says then, this atmosphere of the unexpressed reality of the same thing in itself, which it is in the power of rhythm, of word music, as of all music, to create. It is in the power of the word music to create that atmosphere of the unexpressed reality of the thing itself. And so here the poet, as he says at some length, the poet is not inventing poetry. The poet is channeling from the vital plane, from the mental plane, from the higher mind or overmind, from the psychic plane. The poet is the channel of the thing itself. So in this book, Letters on Poetry, this is a compilation from the other letters, just to dwell for a minute on this idea, Sri Aurobindo says, "Poetry comes always from some subtle plane through the creative vital and uses the outer mind and other external instruments for transmission only. The most genuine and perfect poetry is written when the original source is able to throw its inspiration, pure and undiminished, into the vital, and there takes its true native form and power of speech, exactly reproducing the inspiration without alteration of what it receives from the Godheads of the inner or the superior spaces. So he's speaking about the poetry of the Godheads, the principles, the universal truths of things in their manifestation, so that we can come to know both the limited manifestation and that divine reality which is trying to express itself in things. If the substance, rhythm, form, words come down altogether ready formed from the plane of poetic creation, that is the perfect type of inspiration. The overmind is the ultimate source of intuition, illumination, or heightened power of the planes immediately below it. Higher mind, intuitive mind, poetic intelligence. It can lift them up into its own greater intensity, or give out of its intensity to them, or touch or combine their powers together with something of its own greater power. Or they can receive or draw something from it or from each other. The planes. And in one of his letters he says, in all of poetry there are only a few lines that have been touched by that overmind inspiration directly. But he also explains that his endeavor in writing Savitri was to write from that plane. So in response to a critic who was criticizing his repeated use of so-called highlight words, he said, "What of one who lives in an atmosphere full of these highlights? In a consciousness in which the finite, not only the occult, but the earthly finite, is bathed in the sense of the eternal, the illimitable, infinite, the immensities or intimacies of the timeless." A new art of words, written from a new consciousness, demands a new technique. So in the future poetry, Sri Aurobindo is speaking about something which nobody understands. I've read it many times. I've read all the poems many times. And today when I pick it up and read it, I don't know what he's talking about.
Why?
I mean, sometimes he writes 4 or 5 or 6 pages in this, with this power, this incredible synthetic vision of what poetry is, and he's explaining all of the planes and the images and what it's doing. And, you know, you're used to reading prose, philosophy, criticism. And it's only when you start reading those pages aloud and you allow that inspiration to flow through you like poetry, that you begin to get some sense of what he's talking about. At least you know, you think he knows what he's talking about. But you still, you know, if you're honest with yourself, you have to admit that you don't get it. I challenge you. Read the last 6 chapters of the future poetry and tell me what he's talking about. So that book would be on our reading list, and these letters would be on our reading list, and then there's the collected poems. And we're going to read all of these in this class, or at least we're going to read samplings of them. Yeah, all of these books are available at Shabda, which is across the street from the ashram. Here you won't. You might get them at the visitor center. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Ask for them; they'll probably get them.
Anyway, altogether, this is with the future poetry. There's a blue and a pink one and a yellow one. They come to about 400 rupees or so. So, I would like to just demonstrate.
But for me, it's the question comes why we don't understand. I mean, or get it.
Yeah.
I think the first one is that we are not aware of several planes which are existing, and we have no ideas or develop not the knowledge about or the senses or.
Yes, if Sri Aurobindo is writing about overmind inspiration. And he's writing about the kind of poetry that overmind inspiration produces. How could we possibly understand that? He himself says that this kind of poetry is needed. He says this kind of poetry is needed to show us what's possible in the future evolution. That evolution itself isn't going to happen until something mediates between that plane of consciousness and our ordinary consciousness and begins to show us the way of seeing of that consciousness, the way of feeling, the way of being of that consciousness. And then we have an aid, an intercessor, a parakletos. You know, in Greek, parakletos is the divine logos. So, I think I'll save the little bit on English accent, stress, and quantity until next time, and we can go a little bit more in depth into that. There are 2 things, I think, to be realized. One is what we've been talking about, that Sri Aurobindo's poetry is unique, and that the principle and power of mantra is being applied in a way that it was not previously applied. And the next, and so that's more the metrics and the music. The meaning is that the poet is describing the processes of being and knowing on the planes, the godheads of the planes, the powers of the planes, the vital as a whole is his territory. The mind as a whole, the intuitive and higher mind as a whole, his consciousness is dwelling on the universal plane level. He is not speaking from mortal experience. Even if he speaks about mortal experience, he is not speaking from the plane of mortal experience. So, one special poetic experiment that he conducted at the time that he was writing Ilion and Savitri is called Ahana. And this one is different from the others in that it combines quantitative hexameter with rhymed couplets. Normally he writes free verse or unrhymed verse. And Ilion is like that. He uses different kinds of rhyme in different poems, and in Savitri he uses different kinds of rhyme. In this poem, which is especially musical, he uses both quantitative hexameter, which he doesn't use in Savitri, it's pentameter. And hexameter is a very long line, which is actually two lines of poetry combined with a change of meter between them. And it requires, as he explains, it requires an extraordinary concentration of speech, an extraordinary power of speech, and also of the balance from line to line and page to page and so on. So this is Sri Aurobindo's poetic art at its absolute height. But he's using it for a very light melodic purpose. And the meaning, as always in Sri Aurobindo's poetry, is that he is performing the Vedic sacrifice. He is aspiring to the plane of the gods, communicating with the gods, and allowing the gods to respond through him. That's the meaning of all of his poems. So let's see if I can read a few lines. His little introductory thing says, Ahana, the dawn of God, descends on the world where, amid the strife and trouble of mortality, the hunters of joy, the seekers after knowledge, the climbers in the quest of power are toiling up the slopes or waiting in the valleys. As she stands on the mountains of the east, voices of the hunters of joy are the first to greet her. So Sri Aurobindo is identifying himself here with a type of humanity that we would probably learn about only in the classics. The hunters of joy. Those for whom the delight of life is paramount. Should we dare such a thing? These ascetic and serious souls striving for transformation, should we dare such a thing? Well, Sri Aurobindo seems to think that it has some importance. Vision delightful, alone on the hills, whom the silences cover, closer yet lean to mortality. Human, stoop to thy lover. Wonderful, gold like a moon in the square of the sun where thou strayest, glimmers thy face amid crystal purities. Mighty thou playest, soul on the peaks of the world, unafraid of thy loneliness. Glances leap down from thee to us. Dream seas and light falls and magical trances. Sun drops flake from thy eyes and the heart's caverns packed are with pleasure, strange like a song without words, or the dance of a measureless measure. Tread through the edges of dawn, over twilight's gray-lidded margin, heal earth's unease with thy feet, O heaven-born delicate virgin. Children of time, whose spirits came down from eternity, seizing joys that escape us, yoked by our hearts to a labor unceasing, earthbound, torn with our longings, our life is a brief incompleteness. Thou hast the stars to sport with, the winds run like bees to thy sweetness. Art thou not heaven-bound, even as I with the earth? Hast thou ended all desirable things in a stillness lone and unfriended? Only is calm so sweet. Is our close tranquility only? Cold are the rivers of peace, and their banks are leafless and lonely. Heavy is Godhead to bear with its mighty sun burden of luster. Art thou not weary of only the stars in their solemn muster? Sky-hung, the chill bare plateaus and peaks where the eagle rejoices in the inhuman height of his nesting, solitude's voices making the heart of the silences lonelier. Strong and untiring, deaf with the cry of the waterfall, lonely the pine lives, aspiring. Two are the ends of existence. Two are the dreams of the mother. Heaven unchanging, earth with her time beats, yearn to each other. Earth souls needing the touch of the heavens' peace to recapture. Heaven needing earth's passion to quiver its peace into rapture. Marry, O lightning eternal, the passion of a moment-born fire. Out of thy greatness draw close to the breast of our mortal desire. Is he thy master? Rudra the mighty, Shiva ascetic, has he denied thee his world? In his dance that they tell of, ecstatic, slaying, creating, calm in the midst of the movement and madness, stole there no rhythm of an earthly joy and a mortal sadness? Wast thou not made in the shape of a woman? Sweetness and beauty move like a song of the gods in thy limbs, and to love is thy duty, graved in thy heart as on tablets of fate. Joy's delicate blossom sleeps in thy lids of delight. All nature hides in thy bosom, claiming her children unborn, and the food of her love and her laughter. Is he the first? Was there none then before him? Shall none come after? He who denies, and his blows beat down on our hearts like a hammer's, he whose calm is the silent reply to our passion and clamors, is not there deity greater here, newborn in a noble labor and sorrow and struggle, than stilled into rapture immobile? Earth has beatitudes warmer than heaven, that are bare and undying. Earth has beatitudes warmer than heavens that are bare and undying. Marvels of time on the crest of the moments to infinity flying. Earth has her godheads. The Tritons sway on the toss of the billows, emerald locks of the nereid stream on their foam-crested pillows. Dryads peer out from the branches, naiads glance up from the waters. High are her flame points of joy, and the gods are ensnared by her daughters. This poem is about 20 minutes long, or 25 minutes long, and it ends with an absolutely ecstatic, triumphant joy. It's quite incredible. And so another principle of mantric poetry, as Sri Aurobindo applies it, is that its rhythms gradually bring you up to that level of inspiration where you see those qualities and they begin to flow like honey in the atmosphere. This is Sri Aurobindo's poetry. Comments? Questions?
For me, is, I just read today from Amita Mira, this, she said she's first in the outlet today, an article in her talk, she had in the Savitribha, and when she started reading Savitri, she said, asked in all the ashram if one had heard Sri Aurobindo and no one had heard. So then one time she describes in outlet today, and this is a new one, that Sri Aurobindo came to her in a vision night and talked 20 minutes or so reading Savitri. And she describes how it was. Yeah. So very calm, very soft, very sweet, soft, calm. And that is the one thing to which I touched me and how it could be. And the other thing is I worked, and that would be one, look at one of the quality. The other side would be that I worked 20 years in a radio station and did radio plays with children and actors grown up recorded. And one thing was to choose an actor or the children, if they can, the word which they see, maybe the flower or a car or sound, if they have the imagination in it and then express it through the voice, the direct perception of the world. And not in an equal way, but in the direct perception. So that is, for the people who listen it at the radio, this imagination becomes living. That was quite a quality that only a few actors could do. And especially very young children could do it. After 4 years old or so, they can do it very naturally.
So one thing I would like to do,
it would be just to the sound and,
speaking along those lines,
yeah.
One thing I would like to do that I've never done before is teach some people here how to read Savitri. And I'll tell you for sure, it's not calm and quiet. That's an absolute misinterpretation. But when you hear Sri Aurobindo speaking to you in silence, of course there is that impression. But actually Savitri itself is not at all like that. And I can demonstrate that quite easily. And so in order, the way to learn to read Savitri is, first of all, to open your throat chakra, as if you were an operatic singer. But you don't have to have the range of an operatic singer. Because what happens is the poetry itself, the rhythm of the poetry itself, changes your vocal vibrations. And Sri Aurobindo's voice was very high-pitched. And sometimes you can hear that high-pitched quality as if he were standing right there beside you. But in order to get to that point, you have to liberate your voice. So when I was struggling with this in my early 20s, I once went to the mother with this aspiration. And I was sitting outside her room waiting to see her. And then it became my time to go in. And I had articulated what it was I was coming there for. And she had communicated to Maggie that I shouldn't say anything when I came inside. So I was walking towards her room, and suddenly there appeared in space a silver sphere, just as real as a UFO in space. And as I walked toward her room, this thing went right into my throat. And I couldn't believe it. I didn't know what was happening. It was just an experience. So then I went inside and I sat down in front of her. And she smiled as if to say, and I could feel this vibration so clearly, as if to say, "Did you get it?" And later, little by little, my voice started to vibrate in a way, if I picked up the poem, it would just start to vibrate without me trying to say anything. And so there is a quality of flow in Sri Aurobindo's poetry that this guy up here cannot understand at all and cannot deal with. And it says that on the paper here too, which I didn't get to, where Sri Aurobindo says, we're not through yet officially, so I can just read a couple of other things here. I hope people aren't getting impatient. The key is here, says Sri Aurobindo. If we are to get a true theory of quantity, the ear must find it. It cannot be determined by mental fictions or by reading with the eye. Quote. So, this is not to say that there is not a subtle hearing of Sri Aurobindo's poetry, which is possible. There is. And it is not to say that you shouldn't read Savitri with your mind, because it's also a sutra. But the ultimate intention of Sri Aurobindo is to reveal truths to you through the power of the rhythmic mantra. That's his ultimate intention. But all the other levels of reading and understanding are also possible. So we have to have a kind of flexibility of interpretation here when we hear things and say things. And certainly he spent a lot of time speaking to poets around him about different planes of poetic inspiration and how perfect poetry can be written in other ways from other planes. But that's not what he's doing. That's what his disciples are doing in order to learn to be receptive. He was telling them that. And so we can also write poetry. I have written poetry, and it's wonderful to write poetry. And everyone should write poetry. So let us write some poetry. And you will find out as we go through this process that you start to hear poetry and to see poetry, and you can write it, even if it's only a few lines, and it will be beautiful. So that we can do that, and we can practice some reading and using the voice. And in the end, we should know a lot about Sri Aurobindo's poetry. We should start to discover a little bit about our own poetry, and perhaps Sri Aurobindo will have a chance to do a little work on us along the way.
Hey, I'm sure, because all energy in the building changed by level reading.
Yeah.
Magic.
I did a reading at the Parliament of World Religions in Chicago in 93 to a completely uninformed audience. And at the end, one person there was completely full of a kundalini descent, and she sat there with me beside her for about 15 minutes processing this energy. So we have done workshops in America for 15 years. Every summer we did week-long workshops. And so we know a lot about how this poetry can become a link, a true link to the transformational energies that we experience here sort of in a kind of a subtle way all the time. But it can become quite focused. And it's Sri Aurobindo's energy, it's his presence that's invoked. So that's the secret.